This time on the show, courage is not the absence of fear, Goodreads is my enemy, and I would regret it if I didn't try. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live every other Wednesday at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan. Comics.aadl.org, right on the corner of 5th and William. My name is Jersey Drozd. I'm a cartoonist and teaching artist, and this is the show where we talk about visual storytelling, comics illustration, comics lifestyle. Anybody who's ever been remotely curious about what goes into making visual storytelling with drawings and illustrations and designs, or what it's like to be a cartoonist, this is the show for you. And I am joined today by somebody who I'm very excited to talk to, Mr. Dan Santat of D. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I got to get your URL right. It is dantat.com, yeah?
Yes.
Yes. So, oh, man, let's go down your credits. Man, this is going to... I'm going to blast through this because there are a lot of credits here. I mean, just what you got coming out in 2012 is ridiculous. I'm wondering...
I will agree to that. Yes,
I'm guessing. Are you doing all of these books in 2012 this year?
Yeah, I'm pleased to say that I've managed to keep my family well fed for the year, and most importantly, I'm really happy with the quality of the work that came out. You know what? It started out where I was getting some jobs, and sometimes you know when you get a freelance job. Offered to you, you take it because, you know, it's the next job you do because you have to eat. And then I ended up winning an award at the Society of Illustrators, and then the phone started to ring, and I started getting these really nice projects that I really couldn't say no to. So two projects turned into four, which turned into... 2012. I have seven books coming out.
Yeah, I was wondering. We can name these books. So you're a cartoonist. You're a graphic novelist. You've worked in the animation industry. You created The Replacements on the Disney Channel. Yeah. Your book from Scholastic. Your graphic novel is Sidekicks, which we'll talk a little bit about in a second. But I'm wondering if we can kick over to the video, Matt and the guys in the production room. If you can kick over to the video while we talk about all of the books you got coming out in 2012. This is absurd. How many books are coming out? So. Want to start naming them and telling us about them while we...
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I have... This is The Three Ninja Pigs, written by an author, Corey Rosen-Schwartz. This comes out from Putnam Books in October. This is a galley for a book called Oh No, Not Again. I did a picture book last year called Oh No, or How My Science Project Destroyed the World. It was written by Mac Barnett. This comes out... I want to say June...
Are we looking at a pre-production slick?
Yeah, this is like this is what they call a FNG, a fold and gather. And then this is one that comes out in April or May, I think. It's called Dog in Charge, written by K.L. Going, who's she's a YA author, and this is her first picture book. I have this book coming out in a couple weeks. It's called Bock and Roll. It's a sequel to... a book that I had done back in 2007 called Chicken Dance. I have others. I'm working on a book right now with Amit Zappa. I'm working on another book, The Guys Read Anthology, which is edited by John Sheska, for those of you who are familiar with the Stinky Cheese Man. What else do I have? Oh, I have there's a great book that I just finished, written by Michael Buckley, for those of you who are familiar with the Sisters Grimm series. He did a picture book called Kel Gilligan's Daredevil Stunt Show. And I don't want to say that any particular is my favorite, but this one's probably the funniest one of the year. And it's just about a kid who he just takes the ordinary aspects of his life and turns them into these huge events. Like, you know, he says, "Oh, for my next trick, I will eat broccoli," and the whole family just says, "Oh my gosh, bro!" other books
let's for see, a little kid, that is a daring thing, you know.
Exactly. And so, Let's see. What else do I have? I have another one called Fire Fuego Brave Bomberos.
Yeah, there's a video where that's right on your main page when you go to the website. You can watch a trailer for it.
There's another chapter series called Nanny Piggins and the Wicked Plan, which is a sequel to The Adventures of Nanny Piggins by Rachel Spratt.
So in other words, you are working all the time. You are always, always working.
I am. And, you know, it makes me feel comfortable knowing that I'm always working.
Well, yeah, that's a good problem to have, right? I mean, it's like economy, whatever. Look at what Dan's doing. But I want to talk a little bit about Sidekicks now. Matt in the control room, I'm hoping, can we queue up the video for the Sidekicks trailer while we talk about it a little bit? Okay, so Sidekicks, this is a graphic novel, and this is where I want to say to people who are watching, anybody who's an Avengers fan, if you're going to take your kids to see the Avengers this summer, then right afterwards what you should do is take the kid and go pick up a copy of Sidekicks, because what's Sidekicks about, Dan?
Sidekicks is about a superhero named Captain Amazing who has fought crime in the city of Metro City for years, and it's one of these cases where this superhero is so busy fighting, you know, protecting the city, that he never really had the opportunity to start a family of his own. And so he kind of fills this void by adopting pets. And the story revolves around these neglected pets who are always at home, hoping to spend some quality time with him. Captain Amazing, his weakness is that he is allergic to peanuts. And so early on, he gets knocked into a peanut stand, and he has to retire from crime fighting for a month until his body heals. And at his old age, he realizes he needs to audition for a new sidekick to help him fight crime. And so these pets, who have lived at home with him all these years, they all decide that they should all audition for this sidekick job so that if one of them gets to the job, they can spend more quality time with him and pretty much declare themselves a favorite house pet of the house.
And there's a bunch of really awesome characters in this. You've got Fluffy, the All-American Hamster, and Shifty, a.k.a. the Chameleon, Manny, Static Cat, and Roscoe, a.k.a. Metal Mutt. So this is published by Scholastic. It's a great graphic novel for kids. And I mean, I think it's awesome that it's coming out now when The Avengers is coming out, because it's a perfect time. No, it's been out for a while now, right? Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But you can go get it right after seeing all the superhero blockbuster films. And then, because you know what? This is where I'm talking now to the dad who says that I'm a Captain America man. My son's going to be a Captain America man. When I was a kid in the 80s, we had new characters coming out like Blue Devil, Booster Gold. And it was really awesome that I got to talk to my dad, who was a Justice League fan, about Booster Gold's like my hero who gets to interact with Green Lantern, who is your hero, old man. Sidekicks is for the next generation, right?
It's funny. Someone had pointed out to me, it was this parent, and I don't know if this was a compliment or, you know, a piece of advice, but, you know, he was making referrals to comics like Jared Krasoska's Lunch Lady, you know, Baby Mouse from Jenny Holm and Matt Holm. And how that's for a younger audience. And then the next progression would be, you know, graphic novels like the Amulet series by Kazuki Ueshi, you know, Missile Mouse, Jake Parker.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got, the dad said, you know, you kind of fall in between there, you know, like it's like the little step from Baby Mouse and then to Sidekicks, and then to Amulet. And his advice to me was, you should age it up so that it's up there with Amulet, because that's where, like, all the kids jump to next. And when you go to the bookstore, it's not... I didn't quite understand, because when I go to a bookstore, graphic novels are just with graphic novels. But he said, oh, yeah, when I went to the kids section, yeah, Sidekicks was nowhere to be found with all the other graphic novels. And I thought, why would it not be
weird
with other graphic novels?
Hmm.
Oh, I don't know, but, you know... it's one of those stories I didn't consciously write for a specific age group. It just happened to fall that way. And I think that's the way I do it with all my graphic novels. I just want to make sure the story doesn't suck.
A mutual friend of ours, Dave Roman, once said
Steamboat.
To me, Teen Boat. Yep, wearing the Teen Boat shirt today. Everybody should go out and get Teen Boat next month. And that's at teenboatcomics.com, by the way. He once said to me something that really stuck with me. I was talking to him about a plan for a comics project that I wanted to do, and I was going into, I'm going to do this with marketing, I'm going to do that with marketing. And he was like, whoa, 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 whoa. He's like, you do know your first priority is to make a good comic, right? I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, we can sometimes distract ourselves from actually just committing to a good book that makes us happy, because that's what's really important, is that love has to show before anything else. And then you can figure all that other stuff out in the back end. I really do think that Dave should, rent out his time as a comics therapist. He could be like the Dr. Katz of the comics industry if he really wanted to.
I'd have his own little web show.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Your deal.
I would stop doing this. There's no need to do a comics talk show anymore if Dave was doing this. I'd back off gracefully and gratefully. I'd be, finally, I can watch something. But, okay, we'll talk more about your projects, I'm sure, as we cover this topic today. So we're going to talk about fear, courage.
Yes.
We're going to talk about this thing that... I'm going to try to frame this discussion before we dive into it. How many times have you heard this, Dan? Somebody comes up to you like, oh, you draw books or children's books for a living and comic books. That sounds like fun. That sounds like you were supposed to be the... Every day must be like Willy Wonka's house at your place, right? And then you give them a pencil and say, draw me something. Like, oh, no. Oh, no, 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 right? It's like, I can't draw a stick figure. I can't draw a straight line. We've heard that a million times. So the normals admit that it's scary to do what we do, even though on the surface they think it's fun. And then even like people who are standing on the outside who want in, it's like once you get in, then it's like you got to keep the gigs going. Like you're talking about all this hard work you're doing this year. You're always running after the next, hunting for the next gig, you know, trying not to starve. So it's a scary business. It's natural that we'd feel fear. But then on top of it all, you are expressing stuff. We just talked a second ago about how you should make something that you love doing. You should make a story that you're genuinely excited about. In other words, you're revealing something about yourself, and revealing something about yourself is a scary business, and sharing it with the world. So how do you... it's inevitable that you're going to be frightened from time to time, and how do you cope with that? Now, you're roughly the same age as me, so I'm going to do... people are going to groan who've watched this show a lot, but I'm going to quote He-Man again. There was a He-Man episode, and this is another thing. Like, you don't even need to watch the show. Just go watch He-Man, the first season, and just pay attention to it, because there's a lot of smart stuff in there where he says, courage is not the absence of fear, but doing the right thing despite being afraid, right?
they should have, like, one of those He-Man memes, like the Ryan Gosling ones. Hey, girl.
But it's He-Man passing on really smart stuff that'll carry through to the rest of your life. But anyway, so what inspired this topic, what got me really excited about talking about this topic in particular, was you wrote a blog post last December on your blog, dantat.com. So I'm wondering if you could walk us through that story. You did a review of, like, you looked at the last 10 years of your life and kind of did an assessment, and you had some observations that I thought were really, really insightful.
Yeah, I think it starts from just when I was a kid growing up. My parents, my father was a doctor, and had this relatively, as Asian parents go, they were relatively, fair and not so strict. But the one thing that they really wanted me to do was be a doctor. And my dad used to pray to Buddhist monks and stuff, like, oh, I want him to be a doctor. Never let me take any art classes because they didn't want me to be discouraged, or they didn't want me to lose that focus of one day growing up and, being a psychiatrist or something. And so all my life, like up to the age, up till, high school, I just thought, okay, well, the next logical step will be going to college, then getting a 4-year degree, then probably going to medical school, and becoming a doctor. And, it's not that my parents ever said, no, you will never be an artist, but it was, why don't you be a doctor and then you can do art as a hobby? And if that works out, then you can be an artist, but it's more important that you find security for yourself. So it was just hardwired in my brain, like all my life, to just take that safe path and not take any risks, because this is a tough competitive world, and you want to make sure that you can last in it. And my parents always felt if you make lots of money, then money will bring you happiness. And I thought, okay. So, you know, I went to UC San Diego, and you know, I was an awful biology student. Like I would take a class on the cell, and we'd take notes on the cell, we'd draw the parts of the cell. And I remember my friend would look at my notebook and say, "That is an amazing picture of a cell, but your notes are horrible." You know, "Oh, check out this mitochondria."
I saw his mitochondria and I cried.
yeah. And it was funny because it was all my friends in art school. I mean, it was all my friends in college that kind of discouraged me from going to art school. They said, you know, like, why are you doing biology? You should be doing art. And again, I could hear myself kind of saying the same things my parents said, like, well, you know, I need to do this cure thing. I'm going to do art as a hobby. If that works out, then I'll move on to art. And, you know, my friends just, they were really pushing me. They said, "You're insane. You should just do this. You're awesome at it. You do it in your spare time." And, you know, some of my biggest influences in my life were, you know, I was reading comics all the time. I was playing, you know, video games, huge, like, LucasArts graphic adventure fan. And I thought, you know, making video games would probably be fun. Making, you know, being an animator or something would be fun. And it was around this time when Lion King and all these movies were coming out, and like CG technology was becoming, it had like this golden age. Like, oh, if you can learn how to use a computer and draw on it, you will make hundreds and thousands.
I remember those Diploma Mill commercials. Exactly. Oh man, look, they would literally show guys, like, it'd be like, get a graphics design degree, and look at all the money that you get to make.
Yeah. And they're like, look at this helicopter. It's like it's like a triangle on top, kind of just like turning.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I'm making $80,000 now. You know, degree in web design. And I think I wasn't so much excited about making lots of money, but I looked at it as an opportunity, as an excuse to tell my parents, look, I can do this and you can make lots of money doing this, not knowing what kind of jobs were out there. You know, it's funny because when you think about growing up as an artist, I never got any exposure to what you could actually do. And so my senior year of college, I had already applied to dental school. And I just had to finish out my year. So I had my last quarter as a senior, and then I was done. I was going to graduate. And I was late for a class, and I went through a job fair, and there was a booth for the Academy of Art in San Francisco, and I looked at the catalog, and it's bizarre how, you know, you don't realize the impact that art has in the world without someone spelling it out for you. So you looked at the catalog, and you say, oh, I can do record albums, I can do video games, I can do calendars, I can do, you know, children's books. And again, like I said, animation was a big thing, and I thought, you know what, I would really regret not trying to get into an art school. Like, if I was going to go off into dental school and not even give art a shot, I would really regret it. And I remember one of the things about dental school was a friend of mine had said, he was at the USC dental school, and he said the first thing they make you do is grab a bar of soap and you have to carve it into a tooth. And I remember I was so excited. Like, I went out and I bought, like, you know, like 5 bars of Zest, and I was like, I'm gonna make the best teeth ever, you know. I had this row of green teeth, you know. And I was standing there with like a knife. I'm like standing there with a knife and a bar of soap thinking, why am I doing this? Like, I mean, after I'm done carving these soap teeth, I'm actually going to have to look at people's mouths.
That's true. If you're going to spend the rest. Yeah. I mean, I just went to the dentist. God bless them. I am so glad that people want to do that. But I don't want to have my fingers in other people's mouths.
Yeah. I mean, it was never my intention to be a doctor. It was just kind of this thing where I thought, you know, I have to please my parents. I have to make them proud. I have to do these things that they want me to do, because I feel like I owe it to them, you know, like they paid for college, they've raised me. And I don't know if it's like an Asian thing or whatever, but, you know, I definitely was one of those kids that grew up and just fell in line with everything my parents said. You know, I drank that parental punch of, you know, oh, well, I will find a girlfriend, and if my mother approves, I can marry her. And I thought, so really, it was like I went to college and I hung out with all these people, and, you know, I realized, hey, this path I'm taking really sucks, and it's really nice to be able to make my own decisions, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I, you know, the last 10-week quarter, I ran all over San Diego just looking for figure drawing classes and just, you know, trying to put a portfolio together. And in 10 weeks, you know, I had a bunch of figure drawings and a bunch of things that I drew. And, you know, the main way I learned was I taught myself to draw by just copying comic books.
Wait a second. I hear it on good authority because I go on Tumblr sometimes and DeviantArt, and I hear that copying is a bad thing to do. That is not a good way to learn.
It's funny. You go to art school, and the first thing that they make you do is to copy the master's originals. You know, like, oh, today we're going to take this N.C. Wyeth painting, and I want you guys to copy it stroke for stroke.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's like walking in an artist's footsteps, and you learn from everything. So yes, no, copying is good. But
what I'm hearing from you is that it sounds like you're a pretty driven guy. You know, there was nobody pushing you into this art thing. There were some people encouraging you, but there was nobody saying, like, you got to go do this thing. You went and did the research and learned how to do this stuff on your own. And here you are. You're enjoying a pretty good career. It looks 2012 looks like it's going to be a pretty good year for you. So I'm going to be devil's advocate on the anticipating somebody in the audience going, what do you got to be afraid of? What is your deal, dude? Are you neurotic or something? How come you're experiencing fear when you're living the dream after all, right?
Yeah. You know, the initial drive. You know, I applied to art school, and I remember when I got in, I had to tell my parents, look, I'm not gonna be a doctor. I'm gonna go to dental school. And it was on my graduation day at college, and I was terrified. I said, I don't know how I'm gonna tell this to my father. He's going to crap all over my dreams. But I said, you know what? Regardless of his decision, if I have to pay for art school myself and I have to be hundreds and thousands of dollars in debt, so be it, because I really want to do this.
Oh, man, I know everybody in the chat just stood up and saluted you.
I told my dad, and you will be surprised. Like, literally, he looked at me and he said, okay, then I guess you're not going to dental school. And it blew my mind. It was one of those fight or flight situations where your fists are clenched and you're having dinner, the graduation dinner, and you're holding up the fork. You're like, I'm not afraid of you anymore, old man. But no, my dad just said, okay, well, tell me about this school. And I told him about the Art Center College of Design. And my mom was thrilled because I'm an only child, and said, oh, it's in Pasadena. You can come home. You can live at home and go to art school. And I said, that will be a cold day in hell. I'll never do that. I love you, Mom.
So you sweetened the pill a little bit with that.
Yeah. So art college was the first art education I'd gotten anywhere. And I went to Art Center.
Dan, we're losing you a little bit. Hold on a second. Let's see if we give the stream a second to buffer while I vamp. And I think the video can't keep up with your gesticulating. You're just too excited.
Okay, I got it.
No. I, it's also just it's just a stream issue. It's Skype is having trouble.
Black hat, your floating head.
I wonder if we need to reconnect or something, because you're coming in really fuzzy all of a sudden. So how about you hang up and call me back real quick, and we'll see if we can get a better connection.
Sure.
And I will go ahead while Dan is calling back, and I will read some of the excellent things people are posting on the Google Plus post that I did asking people for input on this. Here we go. And Dan's back already. Let me see if I can get my mouse to work. Matt, let go of the mouse, for crying out loud.
Sorry.
Oh, no, I had it upside down. That was my fault.
I was doing my best, sorry.
No, Matt, you did fine. Sorry about that. I'm blaming you for something that I shouldn't have. Accept, please. Hey there. Hey there, Dan.
Can you see me?
I'm trying to see you. Matt, let go of the mouse again because I need to hit the accept button. Oh, there we go.
We get to blame Al for that one.
Okay. Oh, okay. So this time it was Al's fault in the production room. How come I can't see the video?
Can't see me?
Oh, here we go. There you are. You're back. And we got a better connection now. So I'll see
you. Oh, nice.
Slight delay, slight interruption in the conversation, but... Okay, so Matt's stealing the mouse back, and we can get back to our discussion about where we're going. So, graduation dinner. Mom says, oh, you're in Pasadena, so you get to visit. And so you got to go to art school. Oh, and I lost him again. Oh, man. Okay, so while we try to get him back...
I'm sorry about that.
No, not your fault. Not your fault. This is the wonders of Skype. She could
for
be
some reason, I can't see you, but...
I will turn on my camera.
Oh, gotcha.
And then we can see each other again. There we go.
Hey,
Dan, how you doing?
Very good.
All is right with the world.
Yes.
So, okay.
I'm, like, pawing at the screen.
Oh, this is just keeping it real. This is keeping it real, this kind of, like, technical difficulty. So, okay, now, where were we? You were at dinner. You didn't have to stab your dad with
the dinner, told my dad about art school. He instantly supported me, which blew my mind. And then at the same time, like, it was beaming, like, I was beaming with pride about my dad. Like, he wants me to be happy. It was never about making me follow in his footsteps and following his legacy. It was, I just... Medicine is all I know, and if you need to be a doctor, I can give you every tool imaginable to help you become that. And, you know, he's happy being a doctor, and I guess he just wanted me to understand that he's happy because of money. No, but, you know, I think what really helped was I immediately brought out the pamphlets and the newspaper articles saying, oh, look, you can make $100,000 designing websites. And he said, oh, okay. So I went to art school, and I attacked art school with this ferocity of, you know, it was a couple of things. I wanted to prove my parents that I could do this. And then the second was, and I don't feel like a lot of art students are aware of this, but, you know, you look out in the world, and there's an insanely huge number of talented artists.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why should I drink the art school punch of, well, if you go to Art Center, you will make a six-figure salary because the degree at Art Center is worth its weight in gold. I just didn't buy that, you know? And you hear that from a lot of art schools saying, if you go here, you're the best of the best. And it's like, well, sure. I mean... maybe I'll get a valuable education, but I, there are plenty of amazingly talented artists out there that never went to art school, and, you know, they do very well. And so I don't want to say I was competitive in art school, but I did not want to, take advantage. Like I didn't want to cheapen my experience by doing anything half-assed. And so, you know, when I came out of art school, I actually had three different portfolios because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had an entertainment portfolio, I had a graphic design portfolio, and an editorial illustration portfolio. And it might have been, you know, in part to, you know, the different teachers that I had, you know. And one of my favorite teachers at art school, he actually went around the classroom. And he was asking every student, like, well, what do you want to get out of this art school? Like, what do you want to do after you graduate? And he went around the room and someone said, I want to be a background painter at Pixar. I want to be a character designer at DreamWorks. I want to create storyboards for Nickelodeon. I want to do this. And he stopped the class and he said, you know, you guys are paying $100,000 for this education that can make you a well-equipped artist for any field that you want. And you guys choose to paint backgrounds for a living with this immense, very expensive talent, you know? And he just didn't understand that. And it got me thinking, you know, because he also said things like, well, do you want to work for the name of a company? Do you want to make a product that you contributed? Or do you want to bring some degree of notoriety to your name? Do you want to put your own imprint on the world with things that you created from scratch. And it got me thinking, and I thought the latter. You know, I said, I think I have stories to tell, and I want to tell them. And in art school, I was trying to do the computer animation thing. And I remember I took my first, Maya class, and I tried to make a 1-minute animated film. It took me 10 weeks, and I hated the experience. Like, when you open a software package, when you open a 3D software package, it's like grabbing an encyclopedia off the shelf and just looking through the J section. And you just need to know enough to make boxes and spheres. But there's all these other dials and numbers that you have no idea what they do. And you think to yourself, why did they make it so complex? And it was just like, it was something that I just didn't want to get involved in. I said, there has to be a better way to tell stories. And so I took the children's book course there, which was it was taught by this great teacher. Her name was Deborah Lattimore. And, she had this great, very optimistic view of children's books, and she was always painting it in this very dazzling light, like, oh, when you do a book signing, you have to invite me and bring lots of snacks. the course was very straightforward. It's, you make a dummy book. You send an inquiry letter to an editor. You wait to hear from the editor, and then they say yay or nay. And it just seemed like it would be more feasible for me to get a book published than to, say, get my own cartoon show. So I graduated from art school, and the first job I got working at a video game company. I worked at Treyarch, which was a division of Activision. They make the Modern Warfare games now. Mm. And I was there for 6 years. A year out of art school, I got my first 2-book deal from Arthur Levine Books at Scholastic. And it was one of these Cinderella stories. People ask me, like, oh, how did you get into the business? And the truth is, I went to this conference, and I put my portfolio in the illustrator's portfolio preview, and I had a dummy book for one of my first picture books. And Arthur Levine, Arthur Levine, for those who don't know, Arthur Levine's the editor of Harry Potter. And, right after the portfolio display, this guy comes up with my portfolio and my dummy book, and he says, I want to work with you. I want to publish this. And I thought, wow, that was pretty sudden.
Did he identify what the quality was that made him make that snap decision? Because I want to back up a second. I want to identify some stuff that you were saying here. It sounds like throughout your experience, you were quickly like holding up what was being presented to you versus what your gut was telling you that you wanted to do, right? Uh-huh. So like, okay, I'm going to try computer animation. That sounds interesting. Oh, mm-hmm. This doesn't fill me with satisfaction. Drop it. Just let it go. I mean, you sound like a pretty courageous and focused guy for the most part. I mean, it doesn't sound like you were full of anxiety as you were encountering all these different decisions.
Oh no, I was totally filled with anxiety. It was the struggle with me, especially in art school, and I think a lot of people have in art school, is when you come out of art school, I think you have to have a plan. You have to know where you want to go. Again, like I said, the insecurity lies in the fact that when I came out of art school, I had 3 portfolios. I didn't know what to do. I just wanted to grab whatever I could. But I knew that the top priority in my career was that I wanted to get into children's publishing. And really, the video game job was, I want this job so that my parents won't get on my back saying, like, oh, why did we let them go to art school, Hey, a month out of art school, I got a job at a video game company. Pays very well. Leave me alone. Okay. Yeah. Like, I got this. Don't worry about it. Yeah. But when I was in art school, the biggest concern of mine was, can I make a living doing this? Can I pay the bills? And so it's just, it's that.
And
it's
you have
that
kids now. And that
is that. Having it's that fear in you that makes you make 3 portfolios where everybody else makes one.
Yeah, well, and this has been compounded in your adult life with having a family. That's got to put the fear of God in you to get some work done and get it sold. I want to back up real quick. Jake Parker's in the chat, and he's asking, Jake Parker of agent44.com. He's been on the show before, actually, everybody.
Jake Parker.
He's no small chef.
That's a man.
New York Times
best-selling Jake Parker.
That's right. We have to say that. You cannot introduce him otherwise. Mr. Jake Parker on the Twitters. And I hear rumors that he's starting up a comics roundtable, or rather a storytelling roundtable podcast with Scotty Young. I'm very excited to hear more about that. But he's asking, outside of art instruction, what did you benefit from most by going to art school? Outside of the actual just instruction part. Oh, are you there? Did I lose you? Oh, no, you're there. Okay.
Oh, I'm here. Oh, what did I get most from art school? You know, I do get this feeling like if an artist were to teach themselves, they could learn the same things that I did. But when you go to art school, it's at a very accelerated rate. And you get surrounded by peers who are also like extremely talented. I've been surrounded by guys who've gone on to do amazing things. And you know, you feed off of each other. You look at what other people are doing and it inspires you. And it's funny about that question, because when I was going to Art Center, a semester tuition was going on about $10,000 a semester, and there's 8 semesters.
Oh my gosh.
And now it's $16,000 a semester.
Oh my gosh, forget it. We need student loan reform, everybody.
And so I get a lot of emails from people asking me, should I go to art school? Should I get my degree? And as much as Art Center has helped me, I honestly can't justify telling people to go there. And basically, when you're done with that education, you have a mortgage on a home.
Well, yeah, that's a friend of mine, Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com, once said that these days, with the price of tuition, in order to get a degree in anything, you have to become an indentured servant after that, right?
Yeah,
you are essentially taking out a second mortgage. You could spend easily $100,000, $120,000 on an education nowadays. That is just outrageous. Yeah. Not to say that teachers are overpaid. Teachers don't get mad at me. I'm
not
a teacher.
Not at Art Center, no.
But it's pretty crazy. But I want to keep digging at this fear thing, because you wrote this blog post back in December where you talked about how being worried and being afraid and really like having that hunger and that chasing after things, it changed the way that you were experiencing your career, because good stuff was happening, right? You were working the video game job. You got a deal with Disney to do a cartoon series, The Replacements. That's a dream job. I remember that you wrote something in the blog post, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to put words in your mouth. That you found yourself missing out on actually experiencing and enjoying those things because you were so worried about the next thing that you had to take on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, being at the game company, you really kind of resent. I mean, there were certain things that I resented about working at the game company, being that, you know, you would be directed by an art director who didn't know how to draw, or you'd be managed by an executive producer that was horrible at managing time. And, you know, it's video game industry's notorious for, you know, crunching. And, you know, my wife never got to see me because I'd have to, you know, do 4 or 5 months working weekends. Oh, and wow. it was this life that I didn't want to have. And strangely enough, I felt doing freelance, regardless of financial security, was going to be better for me because I wouldn't be so stressed about trying to serve someone who needs to get a product done, regardless of how well they manage it. So it's funny because I used to talk to art teachers who said, you know, don't get a job because you're going to fall in love with the money and then you'll never pursue, you know, your own passions. Whereas the opposite happened to me. And I went and got a full-time job, and I resented it so much that it pushed me harder to do freelance. And so now, getting into the video game job, about a year or two into the game job, and getting my book deal, getting it out there and getting it published, you know, Hollywood starts coming in And agents come by and they say, you know, we like the book that you saw. We'd love to represent you. And I went with this great agency here in LA, and then they started having me pitch show ideas to, you know, animation networks. And The Replacements was a picture book idea that I wanted to do. I hate to say this, but The Replacements was the first show that I ever pitched, and it was my second pitch meeting that sold the show. I went to Nickelodeon, and they already had something similar to it, which was the X's at the time. And then I pitched to Disney, and then they had picked it up. And then a year later, it got greenlit, and here I am. I have a show.
But you know what's great about that story? And I mean, because like here you are like, almost apologizing for it, and nobody should apologize for their, and not, I'm not saying you were, I'm saying it almost, but nobody should apologize for being successful or doing a good job at something. But it just goes to show that there's no escape from this, right? There's always, it's like the sun's shining today, but it's sunnier over there, you know? It's like there's always somebody who's going to have it better than you. And if you are, it's like whenever, I'm victim of this one, and I don't know if you are. Maybe some folks in the chat can back me up if this is, or if maybe I'm just petty. But like, I'll read like a blog post about somebody who's doing like having a really good time at something, right? It's like, oh, somebody's experiencing all this great success, and I'm like, man, I should be doing that. They, you know, they're doing so well with this. I got to be doing that too because I'm running out of time. I only got 50 years left at best, you know, to do all the stuff I want to do, and I want to be successful like that too. And then I have to stop and remind myself that. You know, you're not enjoying what you're doing now if you're always looking at what somebody else is doing, right? And what's more is no matter how good it is, landing a job at Disney, it still didn't make it any easier for you, did it? Because you were working the video game job while you did The Replacements too, right?
Yeah, I was working full-time at the game company, and then I was working on The Replacements, and then I was still freelancing at home. And you know what happens is that when you buy a house, the first thing that fills your mind is, I have to be able to pay for this house. Then my wife got pregnant, and then the first thing in your mind is, I have to start saving for college right now. I have to be able to pay for this thing.
Yeah.
And so I think it was my parents saying, money will take care of everything. And I didn't want to let go. I didn't want to let go of the video game job because I thought, what if the cartoon show only lasts one season? Then what? And then... So the entire first season of The Replacements, I was still at the video game job. And then when there was a meeting in Burbank, I would be gone for like a two-hour lunch because I'd have to go drive all the way from Santa Monica to Burbank, go to this meeting, and then leave immediately and go back to the game company and, you know, oh, where were you? Oh, I had diarrhea. Oh, well, you had diarrhea, so obviously you're telling the truth because no one would ever claim that.
That does work. I called in sick for work once when I wasn't sick, and you just say that, and they're like, oh, nobody would say that.
Yeah, okay, well, that's fantastic. But I was just running around just, you know, trying to keep all these things going because I was afraid of losing it all.
Yeah.
And then what happened, I think the biggest turning point was when I had my first son. And, you know, when you have a newborn child, they wake up every 2-3 hours and they have to eat. And, for me, like my daily routine was I would wake up, I would take my young kid to like, you know, infant daycare, and then I'd head off to work at 10 in the morning. And then I would leave the game job at 7, and I would go to Disney until 10, sometimes midnight. And then I would come home, and then I would work on my freelance stuff till maybe 2-3 in the morning. And then I would go to sleep. And that's where having a kid caught up to you, because he would probably wake you up in that small window of time that you had to sleep.
That very critical window of sleep, yeah.
And honestly, for a good year and a half, I was averaging maybe 3 hours of sleep just because I was so worried I was going to lose all this stuff, and I would lose my house, and I would lose, you know, my I wouldn't be able to pay for college for my kid who's only like 8 months old. And so that was always the driving motivation. Meanwhile, you know, the game company was working on Spider-Man 3, the movie game. And it was just, like, I didn't have any fun working on that at all. And while I was at Disney, it's not so much about me creating a show, but pleasing the executives who want to, you know, get a certain rating for a certain demographic. And so you come up with all these ideas, and they, and an executive always has to put their hand on it, you know, like, no, it should be this. No, it should be that. And there was this really huge buildup of insecurity in myself, thinking, you know what? I don't know how to tell stories anymore. I don't know how to, you know, draw anything anymore, because I'm always getting notes that it's wrong.
Man, yeah. When a committee tries to committee your story out of existence, right?
Yeah, and this thing where I was always trying to please everybody, you know, and the last person I was trying to please was myself. You know, and so with the freelance illustration of picture books, my first picture book came out, and you know, I'll be honest, the reviews were so, and I'm really sensitive to like criticism, where you know I'm not angry, but you know,
but you get hurt. You get hurt when you read something.
Of course.
Yeah.
You go on, like, Goodreads is my enemy, and I go to Goodreads and I read reviews, and it's, you know, most of the reviews. A good portion of the reviews for Sidekicks, you know, are favorable.
Yeah.
Then you'll say, oh, this book was great, 3 stars. Well, why was it just 3 stars? You know? And then you kind of, after a while, you realize, oh, 3 stars just means that they liked it a lot, but, you know, they would have given, like, their favorite book 4 stars, because there's no such thing as anything perfect, you know?
Conversely, Dan, I'm curious, are you suspicious when you see 4 or 5 stars? Do you go like, hey, wait a second, were they just doing that because they like me, or because it's like the Groucho Marx thing, I won't be part of any club that'll have me, you know? It's like I personally oscillate between that. It's like I'm the guy who goes, why 3? Hey, it should have been 4. But then when I get 4, I'm like, hey, wait a second, why are you giving me 4? What's really going on here? Are you stupid?
I don't try to question those 4 or 5 star reviews. I just think, you're awesome. Thanks so much. And then you realize, oh, that one guy that came in and trolled and gave me 1 star, 2 stars, it takes like 5, 6, you know, 5-star reviews just to raise that by 0.1. Like, oh, that's good. That one troll ruined everything. And, you know, it's this thing where... I don't know why I'm such a victim to reviews. Like, I just want to make sure, I just want to know that what I do is a good job, and that
you're pouring your guts into it, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like you talked about when you were on The Replacements, you were pleasing a committee, you were pleasing executives. And then when you're doing the children's book or like the graphic novel, like Sidekicks, this is pleasing yourself, and which has a certain kind of satisfaction. You finish the book, you look at it, you get to hold it, and you probably walk around the house with it for a little while, like I know I did. And, you know, you just keep looking, oh, I did a book. And then you want people to enjoy that book, because this is – I gave my copy of my first graphic novel to my mother, and I said, Mom, this is my soul on paper. This is 5 years of my life on paper, because I poured everything I had into it. And she went, that's great, and threw it in the trunk of her car. And I went, oh, it just crushed me. I mean, I know she didn't mean anything by it, you know. It's like she was happy for me and everything, but she didn't realize how much that meant to me. And all this story is trying to say is that – man, we pour our guts into this stuff, and so of course it's going to be hard for us to take criticism and reviews, right?
Yeah. No, exactly. My parents are guilty of the same thing. You know, like I don't. To this day, I don't even think my parents read Sidekicks yet. But you know, my dad will look at Sidekicks and say, "Oh, you would have probably done better if you had more yellow in it." Like, thank you, 2 cents, old man. Yellow in it. You're absurd.
Good day, sir.
Yeah, good day, sir. But in terms of talking about fear, you know,
the biggest fear
was kind of taking that next step and relying on my own abilities to take care of myself and not rely on a big company to finance me, but that I was so disgusted with working at a game company, and I was so disgusted at working at Disney, that it pushed me to this point where I was willing to fall on my own sword if things didn't work out. I said, hell or high water. If I succeed, if I fail, at least it'll be on my own terms. And I left the game company. Actually, to be quite honest, my friend was the art director at the game company, and I had to ask him to lay me off. They were doing a round of layoffs, and I had to ask him to lay me off because I said, if you don't lay me off, I don't think I'll have the courage to quit.
Yeah.
So you have to do it for me. And he kind of looked at me and he said, you know, I was waiting for you to just leave this job because you have so many other things going. And I thought, why are you still here working with us, being miserable with the rest of us? And so...
Oh, man, what you're pointing to is another thing that I hear young artists talk about. And I was guilty of this myself when I was in my 20s. There's this impression we get in our heads that once I score X job, oh, man, when I get a series at Disney, when I get my first children's book, then I'm set. The jobs are just going to start coming in, and I'm going to have more and more opportunities, and I'm not going to have to struggle so hard at this thing anymore. A story that I love to tell is something my wife once said. She said when she was 8 years old, she thought she'd wake up one morning as an adult and say, I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, or whatever I decided, and I don't got to think about it anymore. That's like the kid's view of adulthood. You're just set. You are fully formed, and you don't have to worry about this stuff. And here you are with all the success and all these things going on, but yet it was terrifying to give up the regular gig. And that's another thing that I think is a great story to tell people who are interested in this cartooning biz, as well as people who are in the cartooning biz and are struggling with this fear, is that fear never goes away, right?
It never does. It never does. It's you know, working at Disney, if anything, working for a place and just being governed by too many chiefs, if you will, it just constantly makes you second guess yourself and you'll be miserable. I mean, working at a place like Treyarch, working at a video game company, every day you just get this thing dangled over your head saying, if you don't do this job, we'll always find someone to replace you.
Yeah.
If you work in freelance, the only person you can blame is yourself. So you're putting your heart into everything.
Oh, man. Yeah.
If results come from it, then you've done you've done a good job. If not, then you didn't work hard enough. But strangely enough, I've actually felt more job security being a freelancer than I ever did working a full-time job. And it's because I'm not constantly being threatened by anybody.
Yeah. Merlin Mann once said, once you start working for yourself, you will be surprised at how hard you work because once you've had a taste of being your own boss, you are so terrified of the notion of having to do that for somebody else that you'll find yourself working three times, four times as hard because I'm not going back to that if I can help it.
I do. That's my motivation now. Yeah. Like now my motivation is I don't want to have to get a job. I like working in my studio. I like,
You got a chalkboard wall behind you. I mean,
exactly. I can play Mass Effect if I want to right now,
Won't because you're deadlining, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, it's hard work and there's a lot of discipline involved. But, you help the time pass by working on your Photoshop file on one side and watching, Community or, Netflix on the other half of that screen. And time just flies,
Yeah.
And it's not something that you would probably be able to do so much at a 9-to-5 job. I love being my own boss, I get to call the shots. I mean, really, when you work in publishing, it's you, an editor, an art director, that's it. And it just helps. It helps keep the vision of your product nice and pure. And I think there's probably I've heard this from some people that there might be this misnomer that, an editor is going to tell you how to tell your story. And that's not the case. What happens is in children's publishing, I should say, they'll ask you, what is it that you want to say in this story? And you tell them what the message is, and they'll read it, and they'll say, that's not what it's saying. Try to work on that because it's not clear. And that's all it is. It's just, it's hurting you in the right direction. And that's all, I love to figure my own things out. And when I do books now, I prefer doing all the design and all the typography. I like to just have 100% control of it because, not because I'm vain, but because I just feel as a product – if there's that seamlessness between the art and the design, it just makes a stronger product. And that's all I'm really about. I'm really about making the best thing I can.
One of the funny things when I think about artists who throw the vanity word at each other is ultimately, I mean, I work in comics, so one of the things that I'd like to tell people is that the great thing about comics is you can be kind of famous, but not really famous at all. I can go to the grocery store, and I'm world famous to like 300 people, but I can go to the grocery store and not be recognized. But even if I was like super famous, you know, even if I was like a big hot artist, I could go to the grocery store and not have to worry about people trying to get at me. What I'm going with this is that... This book says Dan Santat on it, and it's a Dan Santat production. It's got all of your topography. It's got all, you've thumbprinted everything in this book. Ultimately, that doesn't mean that the general public is going to go, "Oh, look, that's him! That's him! You see him? He's coming! It's Dan Santat!"
Yeah.
You know, you can't throw the vanity word at it. It's because ultimately, illustrators and comic book artists and et cetera. Ultimately, don't really have what anybody would call fame. It has to be a quality control issue, right?
At this point in my career, you know, I think one of my personal goals in my profession is, it's this thing where I should really just be concerned with pleasing myself, but there is something about wanting to be admired by your peers. Like you want to know that you can run with the pack, that you're not this hack. It's like, oh yeah, that guy. You know, you want to have people that you admire greatly say like, oh, I admire your work also. You know, I think every artist has that in them to want to know that they have some kind of validation in the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll hear it from people like, oh, I don't care what anybody thinks of my work, I just do it. You know, and I think to myself, I think you're kind of full of crap. You know?
you're sharing something that's personal. It's hard for me to swallow that pill that somebody's doing it without any sense of who's reading it or why.
I'll
accept it as a possibility, but I've yet to meet somebody who says really with any kind of sense of sincere honesty that I don't care what anybody thinks. I just do it. If that's the case, why are you sharing it? Why are you tweeting about it? Right. We're getting toward the end, and I want to close with some thoughts on another thing that came to mind as I was investigating this idea of fear, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because I hear this a lot from people. I teach a lot of comics workshops and classes, and I'll see cartoonists, young cartoonists, beginning cartoonists, who just refuse to finish a product or a project. They got a couple pages in. They're reworking it. And I say, just get to the end. Get to the end and finish the thing. And they say, it's got to be perfect. And sometimes and somebody's going to be here listening to you going like, wow, this guy focuses on his quality control. He really cares about it. He's a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. But there's perfectionism and perfectionism, right? I mean, I'm wondering if you could speak to this student who says like, I can't release it. I can't share it. I can't finish it until it's right. Perfectionism as a means to...
I know exactly what you're talking about. It kind of goes back to, and I think this was a lesson that I learned in art school, where when you go to art school, there's always like a pack of people that are obsessed with drawing the perfect nude figure, and they never get past that point. They just need to be able to draw the best elbows or hands, or you know, they need to get that perfect figure down, and you know, you quickly learn that that's never going to be attained. Like, you're never going to be able to draw that. And I saw a lot of people who they never got over that idea of, you know, in order to be a great artist that you had to draw the perfect figure. And by the time they graduated from art school, all they had was a portfolio full of naked people, you know. And then when it was time to get a job, you know, like you'd go apply to some place like Nickelodeon, and it's like, well, we do SpongeBob. We have a portfolio full of naked dudes,
right?
And it's the thought of a person looking at the pebble and not the whole beach. Mm-hmm. And so I know that you know, the stories that I do aren't going to be loved by everyone. And I know that given, you know, the opportunities that I've had, I also can't sit and obsess about what other people would do, because the thing that I learned quickly in freelance work is if you're not true to yourself, you're actually not going to do well. And what I mean by that is a lot of artists, they'll go to art school, and one of the first things they do upon graduation is they'll look at their portfolio and they'll say, can I sell this? Can I make a living doing this? And when you do that, you end up being dictated by the money. You know, you're not trying to draw the way you draw. Chances are you're probably looking at an artist who's been successful over the years, and you're saying, if I incorporate some of the attributes of that person's style and adopt it into mine, then I should be just as successful as that person.
Yeah.
And it never happens. You end up doing a bastardization of a product, and you just end up being that guy who just draws like that guy. But why would they hire you if they can just hire that guy? And I did a post about finding your own style, because that's one of the big things that they talk about in art school, saying, you know, if you really want to make it in this world, you have to find your art style. And my advice to everybody is don't try to look for it. When I came out of art school, I had to start a portfolio all over again because my work was all over the place. And I would come back from the game company, I would go to my studio, and I would just sit with a blank slate. And I said, I'm going to paint something, and I'm not going to stop painting this until I'm proud enough to hang it on my own wall. And 10 weeks later, I had 10 new pieces, and that pretty much defined my style. I didn't have any artwork that influenced me anywhere. I just looked at the canvas, and I painted it, and I relied on my own judgment, saying, what does this need? What is it lacking? And really, going to art school is just part of it. Being able to trust your own instincts and refining them until you yourself are confident in your work and saying that what you do is good enough is what's going to take you to that next level. It sounds really corny, really zen, but it's the truth. Like, if you don't have faith in what you're doing, then why would anybody else?
To that point, and sort of like to rope in some book recommendations into this episode, I brought something that was related to our whole talk. This is a book, 18 Minutes by Peter Bregman, and I'll hold it up for the camera. And let's see, this came out last year, September of 2011, this came out. And it's a series of essays. It's kind of like in the same vein as Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art.
Okay.
And there's a whole section in here on perfectionism, and one of the things that he says in this book that I thought was really insightful was that the world doesn't reward perfection, it rewards productivity. And if you're stopping yourself from actually producing something because you're waiting for it to be perfect, or you're trying to ape somebody else, or you're trying to mimic something else that seems to be selling, and not just doing the work, then... you know, you're never going to get gigs. I started getting attention for my work and got some of my first publishing gigs by just doing the work that I was enjoying doing and having a fun time. Ironically enough, it was while I was working on a book called The Replacements. It was a webcomic I was doing back in 2003, 2004, 2005. And a publisher just saw the webcomic and then emailed me, and the person I was working on with is Sarah Turner of cricket-press.com, and said, we love this comic. Please do that for us and we'll pay you. And, you know, it was work for hire. It was freelance work, but it was on our own terms, where they just wanted us to do it our way and just write a brand new story in that style, which was made it the most fun job ever. And that wouldn't have happened had we not just shared the stuff that we just enjoyed doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, Replacements took 7 years because, not Replacements, Sidekicks took 7 years because after my first book came out, and it came out with the lukewarm reviews, I think I was just really scared to be hurt by the criticism. And I sat back for years just illustrating other people's manuscripts and letting them put their souls on paper. And I would just supplement with the pretty pictures.
Yeah.
So that I wouldn't be the victim of the criticism for the story.
Oh, man, that is a big one. Oh, yeah. Hiding behind somebody else that way. I have done that so many times.
And so it's this thing where, you know, you'd see all your other friends who went into publishing and moving on to doing great things, putting their heart out there and exposing themselves. That's the whole... I guess that's the greener pasture things. It's the envy. Yeah. It's, wow, why didn't I just stick with this? You know, like, I don't want to say wasted 7 years of my life, but, you know, I would be at a different point. I'd probably be on my third graphic novel by now if I just focused on it, you know, if I wasn't so afraid.
I wrote this down. You said this earlier. This was very early on in the conversation when you're talking about being in the dentist school. You said to yourself, I would regret it if I didn't try a career in art. And now you're talking about regret again. There's nothing worse than that, right? Nina Crittenden, NV Crittenden on the Twitters posted, you are so admired by your peers, Dan. So there we go. We were talking about seeking admiration of our peers. So there, you just got it in Twitter, convenient Twitter form, using the Comics Are Great hashtag. So we got to wrap this up, and I want to respect your time, and you know, you got work to do, dude, or at least Call of Duty to play, or Mass Effect 3. Mass Effect 3.
I haven't done Mass Effect 3 because I spent all last year working on books, so Mass Effect 2 was sitting in the wrapper, unopened, and I just cracked it open like 2 weeks ago. And now I'm in trouble because it's like, this is a compelling story. I have to know. Really. It's this binge thing. Like, I had Red Dead Redemption, and I said to myself, if I start playing this again, I'm not going to get any work done. And then you get to this point where you're playing the video game, and you say, I have to finish this or my professional career will be destroyed. So I played Red Dead Redemption nonstop for a week. Like, my wife would come home, how was work? Oh, it was great, but I have a long night ahead of me because I was working all day.
She doesn't watch this, right?
And I finally beat that beast, and I said, okay, I can't touch any more games. I have to go back to work.
That's I'm glad I'm not the only one who suffers with that, too. Fortunately, I am really, really bad at video games, so I can play just long enough to get frustrated, and then it's like, okay, I guess I better work. I'd love to find out what happens next in this Metroid game, but I'm so bad at it that it's... anyway, we should give you a chance to promote some of the stuff. Are you going to be doing any appearances soon? Any places you're going to be?
I will be at the American Library Association Conference, the ALA Conference in Anaheim, signing for several titles. And then I'm also going to be at the LA Times Festival of Books, signing, you know, other titles. I will be speaking at the Icon Illustrators Conference in June with fellow children's author illustrator Adam Rex. What else do I have this year?
This is all at dantat.com, right?
Yeah. I have to. It's been a while since I worked on a post. I apologize, but. Yeah, you know, I'm trying to keep it lean and mean because I have a pretty busy year ahead of me in terms of books.
Heck yeah. Just watch that trailer on your website. Holy cow. It's absurd how many books you got coming out this year.
Yeah, that's right.
But you do school visits? You do talks?
I'm happy to do school visits. And I know budgets are tight for a lot of teachers and schools, so I also do Skype chats. Just email me and inquire about them and... I'll try to fit you in my schedule. I'm also I also feel obligated to do book trailers for all the books that are coming out this year. So I'll be busy doing filming myself, you know, making a ham of you know, like, oh, buy this book. Ooh, dance.
You got some pretty great videos on your website too, so people should go to dantat.com after this episode is over. Go there twice and check out all the neat stuff there. And then also, if you got a young person in your life, or if you're young at heart like me, if you enjoy the kids' stories or the stories that are also good for kids, you should check out Sidekicks. Beautifully illustrated story, Dan. So, yep, there it is.
Nominated for a Children's Book Choice Award. You can go to Book Week online and vote for it.
What's
Jenny Holmes? Jenny Holmes, Squish Super Amoeba is also nominated in that card. Along with others.
Oh, the Skype compression is turning into a robot. So just very slowly, give me that URL again so we can talk about the voting for you for the Children's Book Awards.
www.bookweekonline.com.
Oh, I've totally lost you. I will put it in the show notes. It's totally coming in fuzzy now. But when I will... I will look at your Twitter feed real quick, and I will find that because, oh, come on. I want to view more tweets because I want to find this URL to tell everybody where to go on the audio. Not that people ever write down the URLs in the audio, but, you know, you never know. Okay, so it's bookweekonline.com. /voting/3-4 is where you can go to vote for Sidekicks. If you are so inclined, help a guy out. If you thought his everything Dan said today was really interesting and fun, which I did, you could give him a little bit of a pat on the back by going there and voting for it. So lots of people in the chat saying that they had a good time today. So, follow Dan Santat on Twitter at DSANTAT, DSANTAT, and then dantat.com is the website. Dan, I can't thank you enough for this great conversation today. This was really fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. And, of course, if we're going to do some quick plugs, Dave Roman's Astronaut Academy, Teen Boat, thank you. This would not be possible without him.
That's right. I owe Dave.
Big... Around the World, Jared Krasoska's Lunch Lady series, Raina Telgemeier's Smile, David Small, Stitches, The Unsinkable Walker Bean by Aaron Reiner. Empire State by Jason Nishiga.
Poor Eric in the chat.
Say same difference. Level up. Jean Yang,
that's right.
Yeah.
Who will also be at ALA.
New York Times bestselling author Jake Parker's Missile Mouse.
That's one. Eric already lost track of all of those. This is like being in, trying to be a sign language interpreter for the Micro Machine Man. D. Santat on Twitter. Follow him today. You won't be sorry. And check out his books. And we'll put links to all the things that Dan talked about in the show notes and as well as the things I talked about. So. Thanks, everybody, for downloading and listening. This episode will be available at comicsaregreat.com/CAG49, or it'll also be available at comics.aadl.org. People in the Southeast Michigan area, do check out comics.aadl.org for updates on upcoming comics workshops, events. There's stuff going on at the Ann Arbor District Library all the time, the monthly Comics Artist Forum, as well as Skype visits and all sorts of comics workshops. The summer program is upon us. We're going to have the Comic Book Academy and the Comics Fundamentals courses coming up soon, as well as Kids Read Comics. KidsReadComics.org is coming this July 7th and 8th, 2012, and we've got some pretty exciting people coming to this thing. So you can find out more of that information at comics.aadl.org. So thank you, everybody, once again for participating and downloading. Thanks to Dan Santat. Thanks to Dave Roman of YayTime.com for setting this episode up. Dave introduced me to Dan, and I appreciate that. Until next time, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of ComicsAreGreat.com and Jersey on the Twitters. Okay, bye.